Well, I am honored and delighted to be with you. Coming to Kansas City is indeed like coming home. I grew up near Marshall, Missouri, and in growing up, we always thought that when we came to Kansas City, it was something of a religious pilgrimage to the American Royal and all those neat things. I want to talk about the presence of the Bible in preaching. That's what I'm going to be talking about. I believe that the main problem in preaching in the United States has to do with the fact that everybody already thinks they believe the gospel. And therefore, the preacher must say things that people have already heard and in very reduced kinds of ways already grant credibility. The problem with preaching is that the gospel is not heard mostly as problematic and dangerous and unsettling. So the gospel is an old habit that is not greatly questioned and not greatly valued, it seems to me. Therefore, the task of the preacher, I want to suggest, is to try to cut underneath those assumptions that are not taken seriously. And that poses the question in a technological, utilitarian society like ours about whether there is a way to speak the gospel that is not technological and utilitarian. Or, the way I pose the question, is there an alternative universe of discourse that can keep the truth of the gospel from being greatly reduced? And the way I shall come at that is to say that it is the task of preachers to speak as poets against a prose world. Now, by a prose world, I mean a world that is organized so that even pastoral prayers and love letters after a while come to sound like memos. And by poetry, you will understand that I do not mean rhyme and rhythm and meter and schmaltz, but I rather mean language that moves like Bob Gibson's fastball, that jumps at the right time and surprises and occasionally brushes you back. So poetic speech, if it is worth doing, I believe is the only kind of proclamation that is worthy of the name of preaching. Such preaching, I propose, is not moral instruction. It is not problem solving. It is not doctrinal clarification, it is not romantic caressing, and it is not soothing good humor. It is rather rhetoric that cuts underneath all that to those hidden places wherein people have a chance to be transformed. I believe that we preachers live so close to the biblical text that we very often fail to note its generative and its originary power. And therefore, what has happened in our society, both on the right and on the left, that the Bible has been reduced either in a kind of a technological naivete, so it's what I already thought, or into a kind of an ideological reductionism that serves our despair and our resignation and our conformity. I want to suggest, and I will try to say it very delicately, that the language and shape and claim of the Bible means to make available an evangelical world that really sounds like fiction. So if you say the Bible the way it is, one of the responses you get from serious people is, well, that's all right, but the real world is not like that. So I want to suggest that to do the fiction of the Bible, and I'm putting the word fiction in quotation marks, is a very dangerous, subversive, unsettling kind of business, but that the poet who handles the Bible does not flinch from the sense that this is fiction, because it is not mere fiction, but what it wants to do is to destabilize and to call into question the factual world in which most people think we live. Garrett Green, in a recent essay honoring Hans Fry, has said these remarkable things about the gospel. If it sometimes seems so incredible as to strain the imagination and offend the reason, the wise theologian will attempt no defense beyond a reminder, paraphrasing 1 Corinthians 1, that the fictions of God are truer than the facts of men. End quote. So I propose to you that the task of preaching in this buttoned down, settled, factual world of technology is precisely to verbalize and present fictive alternatives to which we could indeed commit our lives. The general title I have taken for these lectures, which is the same as that new book, is Finally Comes the Poet. And I've gotten that phrase from a piece by Walt Whitman, who probably means something other than I do. But Whitman says, after all the seas are crossed, after the noble inventors, after the scientist, the chemist, the geologist, the ethnologist, finally shall come the poet, worthy of that name, the true Son of God shall come singing his song. So I want to suggest that in United States society, with its technological passion, that after the engineers and the inventors and the scientists and after much control through knowledge, finally, in the voice of the preacher, comes the poet who breaks fixed conclusions and who invites us to new, imaginative, dangerous, subversive possibilities. So I want to focus quite concretely on this strange moment on Sunday morning or Wednesday night or whenever it happens. And in that meeting, I want to suggest to you that there are four members present that we need to take seriously. The first member to that meeting is the text. And I am simply amazed among liberals and among conservatives how little the text is taken seriously. So that's mainly the axe I want to grind. And it probably doesn't like grinding with you, but I will grind it a while anyway. You see, what happens when people come to church is that they really don't doubt the text. But they've been all week in situations where it is nearly impossible to remember the tensiveness and the density and the amazement of the text. And very many people who arrive for this meeting all week have been practicing our nervy autonomy. We have been watching Dan Rather with his little news bites about the world, or we have been listening to Paul Harvey, good day, or we have been paying attention to our ideology of nation or class or sect or sex. And what we have been basically doing is shrinking the world down to manageable proportion. And the text gets so distorted in our trying to remember it that it sounds like Hobbes or Rousseau or Marx or Jung or Jesse Helms or Daniel Moynihan or somebody else. And so the community arrives with the question that they put to the preacher, is there really life in this text? And can you say it any differently so that I can hear it? The second partner to this meeting, and it will sound very strange for me to say this to you, but it is a meeting of the baptized. Everybody there is either baptized or is a candidate for baptism. Whether they know it or not, that's how they are to be treated, as a candidate for baptism. And the baptized community, whether it sort of knows it or not, has made some kind of vague decision about the cruciality of this text. So it is conversation that is held nowhere else in our society, a conversation among the baptized that is shamelessly theological, that is candidly charismatic, and that is naively eschatological. Third partner to this text is that this really is the meeting, that the game is in here. And when the music stops and the rheostat is turned down, then it is not time for cleverness or novelty or advice or scolding or urging or coercion or problem solving or ideology. I propose that this awesome moment is a moment in eternity to see whether the poet can find some words that will break the killing prose into which we have been seduced. And you know, it is a prose world in which you've got to manage it and shape it and get along. And you get along by going along. The question that is present among the baptized in this meeting is the question that comes out of the script. And of course, the hard thing is that the preacher doesn't get a new text. What she's got is the same old text one more time. And she must speak the text that everybody already knows. And the question for the poet is whether you can render the script freshly so that when you finish, there will be a breathless waiting and being stunned and not knowing whether we have arrived at the end of it. And the fourth element in this meeting, at the very edge of the text, is that there is given to us a better world, a new world, a more excellent way that depends on the lips of the poet to get it said so that it is available. See, what has largely happened among liberals and conservatives in the United States is that nobody really believes a new world is available. This is the only one, and there are no more gifts to be given. That's what drives our defense policies, is because we don't think there's anything but this, so we better guard it and keep everything we can. So I want to suggest that the only way you can speak about a different world, a better world, a more excellent way, is to engage in a little fiction out of the text that crashes against our realism and causes people to imagine and dream and hope that it could be otherwise. So then the meeting is over, and people go home. Same old quarrels in the car, same old tensions at dinner, same tired beginning on Monday morning. But a new word, a new hope, a new verb, a new conversation, a new risk, a new possibility. And what that poetry does from time to time is to liberate people to stand up stronger and bolder and more daringly in the face of the world that has grown tired and killing. Because what the preacher hopes for is that this fiction that turns out to be true will authorize people like us to come out from behind our desk and our stethoscope and our uniform and our competence and our credentials and our fears and our publications to be present in the world differently. So I simply mean to make the case that you already know, but to make it again, that this meeting is indeed a life and death matter. And the Prince of Darkness always watches the meeting and hopes that nothing will happen. And the Prince has such powerful allies in this age, as in every age. And against the power of that Prince is the feebleness of the sermon. And sometimes the prince will win, and there will be no new word uttered and no new world given. Sometimes the sermon will have its say, and the world is set loose for healing. Whenever that happens in the sermon, the author of the text laughs the way the author has laughed only at creation and only at Easter. And the dark prince slinks away and knows that a little more territory has been lost for freedom and peace and justice and joy. So what I want to do for these three lectures is to construe with you three lines of poetic imagination that I think are urgent and available for people in our society. And the first one I want to talk about is that the poet is the only one left in our society to talk about the problem of guilt. I do not mean guilt feelings. I mean guilt. There is underneath our fast deceptions about a kinder, gentler America, there is among us a profound sense that it isn't right and it isn't working. And you don't have to have a scholastic theology to know that things are terribly skewed and distorted. What the Bible script lets the preacher do is, on the one hand, to be honest about the guilt that our life is fractured. The second thing that the text lets the preacher do is to entertain the outrageous possibility of reconciliation and forgiveness and restoration. And the third thing that the text lets the preacher do is to walk with people the tortured way about how you get from guilt to forgiveness, because it is a tortured, difficult, slow way, and it will not be handled by any neat, clean, ideological formula. Now, everybody already knows that. The problem is that our understandings of guilt in religious categories in our society are so terribly reductionist. On the one hand, guilt is handled in our society in terms of strict retribution, and people ought to get what they got coming to them. You can see that those people are getting what they got coming to them. You can hear that about the losers. Or on the other hand, if you want it a little higher, you can reduce the problem of guilt by saying, I've been saved by the blood. And that doesn't cost anything, and it's all settled, and it's neat, and it's clean. Now, I think the third reduction that I could think of is not a Baptist temptation, but in some other circles, the third way of handling guilt is to say, have a nice day. So I submit that preaching takes place in the community of the baptized among people who do know deep in their lives about the power of guilt, and who have deep in their lives the yearning that they do not trust anymore, that it doesn't have to be this way. But it is so deep that it is not available, and it is not understood, and it is not embraced, and it is not practiced. So the preacher has the task and the script and the chance to bring that stuff up to where it can be processed. What I want to do quickly is to outline a taxonomy of guilt and grace. So this is a little exercise in biblical theology. To start with the assumption that most people who come to church have grown numb, don't dare notice, and so we engage in massive denial. I read recently the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this person who did it was one of the founders, said that it is enlightenment denial that has generated the great disease of alcohol among us. And you know that Robert Lifton has written book after book about the crisis of psychic numbness, so that we've got a society in which nobody notices anything anymore. You can't afford to. How are things going? Everything is fine, Pastor. So in this taxonomy, that people need to be brought through with pastoral delicacy. First point is that the problem of guilt and grace begins with candor at the throne of God, that we have to do with the one from whom no secret can be hid. God has noticed. And if God has indeed noticed, then there is very little mileage left in our not noticing, because it's already known where it counts. Now, the text that I stumbled on for this, and you can pick many others about candor at the throne, are the savage poems of Jeremiah. Jeremiah 5, your iniquities have turned these away, your sins have kept you from good. They set a trap, they catch people like birds in a basket, and therefore, doesn't this sound so contemporary, they have grown great and rich and fat and sleek. What was it, $2 million in Japan, quickly? And they judge not with justice the cause of the fatherless, and they do not defend the rights of the needy. Prophetic ministry is simply making available in the community what God already knows and has commented upon. And the wonderful thing about the text, the way Jeremiah puts it, is at the end, he doesn't pound and hammer people. He just has God say, or God just has Jeremiah say, whichever way you like that, shall I not punish them for these things? And the question is unanswered. You think about that question, Jeremiah says. You think what God ought to do. You think what you would do were you God. The second step in this taxonomy is that when God notices, God is filled with indignation and wrath and anger. This God is no good warm buddy. This God will not be mocked by the distortions of our society. And there's nobody left in our society to talk about the deathly distortions that are chewing people up and affronting God. So God, in this anger and affront, says, how, Jeremiah 5, how can I pardon you? Shall I not punish you? Shall I not avenge myself? And what this whole scripted tradition wants to say is that being God is very serious business. And God is not mocked. And when we notice the rage of God about the distortions of our life, one of the things that begins to happen, says the poet, is that people who notice God's notice can begin to blush. You see, one of the sicknesses in our society is that there is nothing left for which to blush. Third, what happens in the throne room in the body of the affronted God is that there is also present God's utter anguish at having been betrayed and having yearned and having failed. People don't know that about God. People don't know that about the Bible. People don't know that God is in turmoil about what is happening to God's godness. Because one of the problems is that liberals think it doesn't matter and conservatives have got it all flat and reduced and safe and settled. There is nothing flat and safe and reduced and settled about God. So in the midst of this massive throne, the Father speaks. The Father speaks the way every father speaks to a teenage child. I think it's on the way home from the police station at 3 o'clock in the morning. I thought how I would set you among my children. I thought all my life, I thought how I would give you the best land and the best stuff. And I thought someday you would figure it out and you would call me my father. When you were a little child, I dreamed of your growing up, and I worked all my life for this good for you. And now you are faithless and fickle. And if you listen long enough in the throne room through Jeremiah, after the Father God finishes the grieving, you can hear the Mother God speak present in the throne room. He's Ephraim, my dear son, my darling child. For as often as I speak against him, as often as I tell him I don't want his name mentioned again, I do remember him still. Therefore my heart yearns, and I will have mercy. So the father yearns and quits in dismay, and after the voice of the father has become silent, comes the voice of the mother, who finds that she cannot turn loose of her beloved child. And then, unlike any caring parent who watches while the child suffers, this God, through the poet, says, "Oh, that my head were waters and that my eyes were fountains of tears. I wish I had bigger tear ducts. I got so much crying to do." So the judge remembers to be a parent, wistfulness and yearning at the deathbed. God has noticed, and it all depends on a poet to get this said, to cut underneath all of the scholasticisms that have emptied God of God's freedom to care. Now, to get this taxonomy said, what I decided to do was to move from Jeremiah to the book of Leviticus. Strange, huh? You don't even have to believe the documentary hypothesis to be Leviticus is hard to get at. But in Leviticus 6, there is a remarkable statement by the priests who knew a lot. They do a diagnosis of the problem. If anyone sins against the Lord by deceiving his neighbor in a matter of deposit or security or robbery or capital gains, they knew. They knew that the way you affront God is to violate your neighbor's chance to live. Stocks and bonds and value and property and power and taxation. The power to hurt and to violate is present in the public domain, but it's present in power relations in the family, in sexism and racism and ageism, and in Central America. We have been discovering now that if we've been taking food off of the tables of peasants and enjoying the fruit of the United Fruit Company. So the fourth point in this taxonomy, the priests say, if you've been doing that, what you got to do is to restore the stuff. You got to give it back. That is very good news. You can do something about the distortions that have generated the guilt, and you got to act. That's good liberalism. What you do matters. And then the priests say, "Oh, by the way, add 20% to it." My word for that, our word for that, is the fourth element of the taxonomy. You got to make reparations. You got to get out of your seat, take an act, change a policy, and restore stuff so that the community can function. So one of the themes for the poet is to think through, how do we undertake reparations that can change things? And then the fifth element, the priests know a lot about how human persons work and live. And what they know is that after you have done all the reparations you are capable of doing, you will still have in your life a residue of ache that you can't resolve. It just sits and sits. And you wish all your life long that you have never done it, but you have done it, and it is irreversible. So the priests finally are the ones who deal with the residue of ache. And they cannot speak directly about it because it is hidden and inscrutable. And they can only speak in sacramental language. And so they say, bring a ram without blemish, the price of the guilt offering. And the priest will make an atonement for you. It's odd language, but what it affirms to us, and I believe is surely true, that we are not such hotshots as we thought we were in modernity, that we have not outgrown the archaic need to have things done for us that we cannot do for ourselves, and all the freedom myths of the Enlightenment are simply false. So think what we've got accumulated in our society. We got 300 years of unanswered guilt because we have ignored the processes by which the residue of ache can be taken up and dealt with outside ourselves. So we, with Jeremiah and Leviticus, we do anguish. Finally, the priests come to know that we cannot alone do our healing. The priests know that healing requires the submission of something of value. The priests know that healing is an act of covering over, sealing off, shellacking the poison, almost like being sure you lock up nuclear contamination so that it does not poison the environment. The priests know that this is an act done in the zone of holiness, from the other side where you do not tread lightly. So the taxonomy ends in the offer of blood, of self-gift, of the abandonment of self to cover over the poison that is destroying the others. Now I mean to suggest that this taxonomy cannot be laid out in scholastic theology, that this taxonomy is not a set of techniques, 5 steps to happiness. But it is slow, and it is hard, and it is painful. And therefore, it requires the daring of the poet to help us move where we do not want to move. To move into a God who notices, to move into a God who is angry and then yearning, to authorize people to make reparations, and then to wait for sacramental action which will indeed resolve the ache. Now that's a kind of theology that makes scholastic formulae uneasy. It's a kind of theology that Reader's Digest and such theological journals cannot tolerate. Because what we have on our hands in this script is the terrible drama of God's rage and God's hurt and God's ache and God's self-giving love. So I propose that we are at a rare time in the church to get past the silly quarrels between liberals and conservatives, because the twin themes are reparation and residue. And talk about reparations ought to be as radical as any liberal can make them be. As radical as getting things straightened out in the family and in Central America and all the places of enslavement and exploitation. And the poet's theme of the residue ought to be as deep and hidden and sacramental as any conservative can possibly make it. So I simply want to say that the text and the preacher in the community of the baptized has on his or her lips, and nowhere else, power to render a world that is not known in advance. Rendering that world does not require cleverness, but it requires a greater closeness to the text than most of the church practices. And the preacher had better know that that new world is not offered in our neat formulae of morality or orthodoxy or whatever. But it is only offered in the halting way of poetry that seems flimsy and fragile. I imagine that it is for this poetic utterance that the church waits. Indeed, it is for this utterance that the world waits. The world and the church waits until finally the poet comes.
Your presence today is an indication of your anticipation. Your presence tomorrow will be a corroboration of your experience. And you will be here. I can sense and see that. For our anticipation has been rewarded. And we have one in our midst who, by his presence and by his openness and by his commitment, challenges us to walk with him not only in greater intellectual insight, but in a more complete personal involvement in presence and work of the Father in our midst. Tomorrow's lecture and Friday's lecture, two more, will come and go swiftly. Tomorrow afternoon, I believe it's 2:00, in our bookstore, Dr. Berglund will be present to meet with you and visit with you and to autograph any of his works which you may have chosen to make your own. And you'll have opportunity at that time for fellowship with him. We have not sought to overprogram them in our midst, but if other opportunities develop along the way, I'm confident that they will be delighted to spend a few moments visiting with you. Thank you for being here, and thank you in anticipation of your presence tomorrow. Goodbye.